Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Thursday afternoon, April 29th at 1:01 p.m. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good afternoon, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Or send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, sutton-associates.net. In his biweekly newsletter, Andy discusses economic issues and how they affect you. You can also listen to Andy's commentary on contraryinvestorscafe.com. Lastly, I would also like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website, that would be libertytalkradio.com, and clicking on the subscribe icon. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this special edition of Liberty Talk Radio. This afternoon, we are really, truly privileged to have Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, Professor of Economics at Boston University, to be our guest. He is a William Warren Fairfield Professor at Boston University, a Professor of Economics, Fellow of the American Academy of Arts, Sciences, and Research, Associate of the National Bureau of Research, Fellow of the Econometric Society, and former senior economist for the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Among other things, folks, he's written several books. One is Macroeconomics, An Integrated Approach, Essays on Savings, Bequest, Altruism, and Life Cycle Planning. His book before the one we're going to discuss this evening was called The Coming Generational Storm, What You Need to Know About America's Economic Future. Also, another book was Spend to the End, The Revolutionary Guide to Raising Your Living Standard, and also Healthcare, The Healthcare Fix, Universal Insurance for All Americans. And this afternoon, we'll probably be discussing Jimmy Stewart is Dead, his latest book. And this book is about ending the world's ongoing financial plague with limited purpose banking. Well, we are truly pleased to have Professor Kotlikoff on our program. He should be calling in any minute. We do encourage you to listen in and carefully and call in with your questions or comments. We will probably touch on a host of items, and I'll probably start off by asking him, why is Jimmy Stewart dead? And we'll use that as an open focus question. He is a very, very accomplished gentleman. We are very pleased to have him on our program. He recently was interviewed by Andy Sutton, who is with Sutton & Associates. And I think this is where he is right now. Professor?
Hi, Joe. Can you hold 1 second?
Yes.
Professor Kotlikoff.
Thank you, Norma.
Hold 1 second.
Yes. That was his secretary.
Hello?
Professor Kotlikoff.
Yes, hi.
Hello, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
And it certainly is a pleasure to have someone of your status on our program. We certainly appreciate your taking out your valuable time to speak with us this afternoon. It's about 5 minutes after one, and we'll have to about 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. And I already performed the introductions and gave a background, your background, and of course, generally what we'll be talking about. Allow me, Professor, to ask the first question that I'd like to ask is, And I'm sure everyone else is asking themselves the same question. Is Jimmy Stewart really dead?
He's most certainly dead. And the title of the book connects to the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Right.
And what we know is that the movie that's playing on main streets around the country is It's a Horrible Mess.
Right.
That's the real movie that's showing. So this idyllic view of bankers and banking that was portrayed in It's a Wonderful Life, where Jimmy Stewart played the role of George Bailey, and he was an honest, trustworthy banker, and there's a run on his bank, and he saves the day by coming back and talking people out of running on his bank and saying, just trust me and trust your neighbors. Well, that concept is not really with us anymore, because we know that Wall Street has been engaged in the systematic production and sale of trillions of dollars of fraudulent securities, and that we can't trust the local bankers or the big bankers whatsoever. So we need to have a system that's safe from fraudsters and hucksters. And I'm not saying that all bankers and insurance agents, you know, people in the insurance industry are hucksters and fraudsters. It's a small group of people, primarily at the top of these companies, who engage in these practices, and they've taken down their own companies, and they've taken down the economy.
Well, there seems to be a common feeling that in order for this, for banking to work, we need even more regulation. Is that the answer?
That's not the answer at all. We need a simple, transparent system, and I call it limited purpose banking. I discuss it in the book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead. And the basic idea is to draw a line between banks and other financial intermediaries, including insurance companies, that have limited liability and those that don't. Anybody that wants to operate as a financial intermediary, a bank or as an insurance company, where they've got limited liability, namely the people who own those companies can't personally lose their homes and their yachts and their BMWs when their companies go under, anybody who wants to operate with that kind of protection would have to operate as a mutual fund. In other words, they'd have to operate on a safe basis. Mutual funds are themselves like little banks, which can never go bankrupt. They are little banks that take in money, but they don't borrow money. They take in money on an equity basis. People buy shares of the mutual fund, and then the mutual fund invests in different securities depending on what the mutual fund is investing in. So we're all actually very familiar with mutual funds, because for most Americans, the mutual fund system is our banking system. We have our retirement accounts invested solely in mutual funds. Our 401ks, our IRAs, our Roths, they're all invested in mutual funds. So for most Americans, the mutual fund is the banking system. What I'm saying is that we should transform the entire financial system basically into mutual fund companies, and so that the people that the companies that are connecting lenders and savers with borrowers and investors, those companies will be mutual fund companies, and they will, by definition, never be able to fail. They'll never go bankrupt. We'll never have another banking collapse, banking panic again.
There seems to be a cacophony of elements that we can't seem to get our hands around. When the president calls in Bernanke, apparently, even when they are speaking, they are not even clear as to what they're talking about. I mean, the definition of what they're talking about when they talk derivatives and all this other fancy financial packages. How do we get our hands around something that seems to me to be so incredibly convoluted? Everything from close to $250 billion worth of notional value of derivatives, all the way down to simple things like putting your money in a bank, in a savings account, and worrying it, you may not even get it back with or without the FDIC. I mean, the scope of this appears to be so broad, so complex, some dumb kid from street kid from Harlem can't grasp that at all.
Well, I think any kid from either Harlem or Missouri or or Boston, Cambridge, Mass. The way this thing is set up right now, it's very hard for anybody to follow because this community of financiers uses language that to disguise what they're actually doing, which is basically of late engaging in the sale of snake oil. And the mutual funds are a very simple structure. They can never go bankrupt. And mutual funds, there are already 8,000 mutual funds out there, different individual mutual funds. Right. Some are investing in mortgages, some are investing in treasury bills, some are investing in stocks of different types. Some are investing in companies' loans. So they're providing credit to companies and individuals who want to borrow for their homes. And it's working. It's an intermediation process. That accounts for about a third of the financial system right now, the mutual fund industry. I want to make it the 100% of the financial system, because if you look at what happened, the financial system, the parts of the – we had a financial earthquake, and the part that is still standing are the mutual fund companies. And by the way, I don't work for any mutual fund companies. I'm not on the take, so your listeners understand this. Right. I'm not conflicted here. And I think a lot of what the mutual fund companies are doing needs to be fixed, and that's what part of this proposal. But the book is in large part, most of the book is a fun tour by an economist of what happened here in very simple terms that my 12-year-old can understand, because he's actually read parts of it.
Right.
And it's written with no jargon. And the problem is not the risk-sharing arrangements that the it's not that we had CDS, which are basically insurance policies against companies defaulting on their debt, or that we have options and other types of securities out there, which are allowing us to share risks and allocate risk. The problem is that these securities were fraudulent insofar as they were said to be X and they were actually Y.
Right.
When you tell somebody, here's a AAA mortgage, and when it's actually a triple D mortgage, that's just plain, so what we need is an FDA for the securities industry, and that's part of what I'm proposing, not just a mutual fund structure, but also what's called a federal financial authority, a single regulatory body, not 120 like we're about to have, but one, because we're going to have 120 state and federal agencies after this administration is done doing what it wants to do. I want to have one agency, the Federal Financial Authority, which would verify the income and employment statements on every security that the mutual funds hold or buy or sell. It would also verify the collateral on any loans that these mutual funds are dealing with. It would independently rate these securities, so we wouldn't have to depend on Standard & Poor's and Moody's and these other companies being bribed to provide favorable ratings, and it would disclose on the web in very fine detail everything about these securities that's known, so we would actually know what it is we're buying. And then there's third-party custody, which is part of any mutual fund. That's just part of the law that governs mutual funds, the 40 Investment Act. So we would have a federal regulatory body, a single one with a very limited set of things to do, that would make things transparent. And then we would have the mutual funds, and the mutual funds would be of the kinds we'd have the 8,000 mutual funds we now have. We'd also have what are called cash mutual funds, where people just invest in cash, and the mutual fund just holds cash, and they would be used for our checking accounts. We could write checks against those. We could use a debit card to buy things at the store and against those cash balances and our cash mutual funds. We can also access money, cash, from ATM machines. So we would have a payment mechanism through these cash mutual funds. And then the last thing about the mutual funds that differ from the current system is that we would have insurance mutual funds, which would be insurance pools, which would allow you to, for example, insure against your death. You'd have life insurance pools, you'd have longevity pools for annuity insurance, you'd have homeowners pools in case you have a loss to your home, car accident pools. And these things would allow us to share risks as individuals, but not try and insure aggregate risk against. You know, right now the current insurance system is saying that they would pay off our life insurance policies if there was swine flu, if it broke out like it did in 1918. If it did that, we would put all the insurance companies that we now have in the country and around the world under. They'd all go under.
Right,
not only
have
swine
flu
killing us,
right.
it would kill the financial system.
Right.
Because it's the insurance system right now is trying to insure the uninsurable. What I'm proposing through these mutual funds is insurance that does not try and insure against aggregate risk, which is impossible to do. And then the other type of insurance mutual fund would allow us to place bets on whether or not things like IBM defaults, but they would be the kind of bets we do at the racetrack, which is we put our money in. The money is safe there behind the gate at the racetrack. It's called parimutuel betting.
Right.
And at the end of the race, whoever wins the horse, whosoever horse wins, they take the pot less the fee in proportion to what they put in.
Right.
That same thing can be set up for in betting on whether or not IBM defaults. That's called a CDS. So we can have a safe way to have modern financial instruments that does not involve liability to the taxpayer.
Now, I'm a little lost as to what the connection is between me and the mutual fund. Where's the connection there?
Well, you may be involved with mutual funds in different ways. You, as a somebody who's saving money, you would potentially buy a mutual fund that invests in mortgages in Detroit, or you might invest in mortgages that invest in Orange County in California.
All right. And this would be in lieu of my savings account at the bank, you're saying?
So, right. You would not have a savings account at the bank. You wouldn't have a checking account in the bank. You'd have put some of your money in cash mutual funds. Let's suppose that you open up, put money in a TIA Craft mutual fund.
Okay.
Mutual funds of different kinds. You might put your money in their cash. Some of your money in their cash mutual fund. Some of in a S&P 500 index fund.
Right.
Some in a European stock fund. Some in a junk bond U.S. corporate junk bond fund. Some in a Kansas City small business loan fund.
Right.
So you're investing in different parts of the international economy, and in putting your money with these mutual funds, they're taking that money and giving it to the other parties on the other side when they buy their paper.
Right.
So they're providing, you're providing credit when you buy into a mutual fund that's investing in bonds and mortgages. You're providing credit.
Right.
When you buy a mutual fund that's investing in stock, you're buying equity through, you're buying stock through the mutual fund. But you see, the point is that the mutual fund itself, when you put money into the mutual fund, they're giving you back shares to the mutual fund. They're
Correct.
Not giving you some absolute IOU. We owe you this money no matter what happens.
Right.
You're not lending money to the mutual fund. You're investing
right.
in the mutual fund. So if the mutual fund loses everything, you lose your holdings, but there's no liability. The mutual fund itself doesn't go bankrupt. There's no liability to some third party.
That's correct.
So the mutual fund is a natural firewall. What we have under the current system are these financial entities where there's big canals of gasoline running from one to the other. And if one gets lit up, they all get lit up. The entire system goes down, including the insurance system.
Well, that's why
the government has come in here and printed trillions of dollars of money to back up this system.
Right. Well, once I invest money into the mutual fund, that money is used to purchase large cap stocks or whatever the case may be. Where does the money come from which I write my checks?
You earn it. You work. And you also get, if you're retired, you're going to get dividends and capital gains from the mutual funds that you invested in.
Okay.
By the way, you can also, under what I'm proposing, buy individual stocks. You don't have to buy shares of mutual funds. If you want to go buy a share of Intel, you just take, you set up an account where you just invest directly in Intel. So a company like Citigroup would be transformed into a mutual fund company, but they could also, you could also have a private account with them where you would be able to buy individual securities. But Citigroup would not be allowed to have its traders take exposure. They would only match buyers and sellers of security at no risk to themselves. So the idea here is that no financial intermediary would ever have any risk exposure whatsoever. So the trading operations would just be a matching. The investment banking that Citigroup would do would be a pure consulting business. And then they run mutual funds. Very simple.
Okay. Now,
this is simple enough for 500 or so members of Congress to figure out. This is simple enough. If they weren't being bribed $5 billion,
right.
They were paid $5 billion in the late 90s, and they're getting paid again today.
Yeah, but how do we... brings up the question, how do we get anything changed when the pockets are being lined by our legislators to keep everything exactly the way it is right now? I mean, just short of...
Well, we need a solution that's simple, and this is it. If your reader, your listeners go to www.kotlikoff.net and read about limited purpose banking, if they get a hold of the book, they're going to have a good time reading it. It's a lot of fun to read, as crazy as that sounds, if you think an economist can have a sense of humor. But people who have reviewed it said it's a lot of fun to read.
Well, that's great.
And if they read it, if they send it to their members of Congress, they just put it in the mail to their members of Congress and say, read this and do it.
Okay.
So if we get a grassroots thing going here, people take www.kotlikoff.net and email that URL to their friends and tell them to email to their friends, et cetera, et cetera. We get a virus going.
Okay.
And then, look, in the last week, I've talked to Paul Volcker about this. I've talked to economists at the Senate Banking Committee. I've met with Paul Ryan, one of the top head of the House Banking Committee. I've given talks of Mervyn King, who's the head of the Bank of England, is very keen on this proposal or considering this proposal. George Shultz has endorsed this proposal. He's the former Secretary of Treasury. Bill Bradley, Simon Johnson, five Nobel Prize winners have endorsed this proposal. You know, if you look at the endorsements at www.kotlikoff.net of the book, which is really an endorsement of the proposal, you'll see that there's lots of very prominent people from all sides of the political aisle thinking this is the way to go. And yesterday, Martin Wolf, who's the top economics writer for the Financial Times, endorsed the proposal in a column.
Okay.
So this is building. If we can get enough people onto this solution and get it in front of Congress before they just run it, rush ahead and pass a 1,300-page bill that nobody really fully understands.
Right.
And it's never going to, ultimately it's not going to fix the problem because ultimately the guy who's lying about his income and fudging the value of the house he's buying, if nobody's double-checking that, that sham is going to continue.
That's correct, right.
And then nobody will trust you. Think about the Tylenol scare back in 1984 or so, when a few bottles of Tylenol, we think a few, we don't know for sure, in Chicago were laced with cyanide,
right.
And seven people died in Chicago. And worldwide, there were 30 million bottles of Tylenol outstanding in different stores around the world. Suddenly, this big asset, these bottles of Tylenol, went from a value of X to a value of zero in 1 minute.
That's right.
And because there was no disclosure, nobody knew which bottles were tainted and which weren't. So they became real toxic assets.
Right.
Literally toxic assets.
Right.
And so what happened is Johnson & Johnson didn't spend hundreds of millions of dollars in trying to tell people, reassure people, go ahead and buy the Tylenol, it's safe. Instead, what they did is they recalled, at the cost of huge amounts of money, they recalled all 30 million bottles. They threw them all away. They started from scratch. They put fresh Tylenol in the bottles. They put on safety seals. And then they put them back on the shelves. Now, in putting on the safety seal, they were disclosing that the Tylenol in the bottle was actually Tylenol.
Right.
That the pills in the bottle were Tylenol.
Right.
That's disclosure.
Right.
And so you can see why Bear Stearns and Lehman went from very high values to nothing overnight, because nobody but the guys at the very top of these companies even had the ability to find out what those individual securities were that this company was holding. Consequently, it was just like a Tylenol case, where from one minute to the next, people thought everything was toxic,
right.
and they acted on it. So, you know, it became a bet on Jimmy Cain, for example, in the case of Bear Stearns. Jimmy Cain was the CEO. He was the one, and some of his other top lieutenants, who had the ability to know what they owed and they owned. And Jimmy Cain was a guy who was off playing bridge and playing golf and allegedly smoking dope. And at some point, the market decided that they didn't trust Jimmy Cain. And bingo, this company went down the tubes.
Right.
And there was a run on that bank, and then that caused other runs over time. And we're not done yet. You know, this run in Greece is more part of this financial plague that we're facing. You know, it's really a contagious situation we've got.
Right. Let me interrupt you right here, because it's past due for station identification. Folks, you're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased to have with us Professor Lawrence Kutlakoff. He's the professor of economics, Boston University. We're talking about his latest book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead. And I have to admit that I have not picked up that book, because I was just introduced to you this week and I haven't had a chance to read it. So I will do so, and that's why I sound very ignorant to the subject. But you did whet my appetite enough that I can't wait to dive into it. We will promote. Let's try and promote this book as best we can, because we need all the help we can get, and it seems like this is a solution. Isn't before we get on to Greece for a second, because that was going to be my next question, but perfect segue. But there is an illusion out there of regulation and control and of safety when it really does not exist. Am I right or am I delusionary?
Yes, it really doesn't. We would have to have literally millions of regulators babysitting every trade that these folks in Wall Street, and Wall Street's a pseudonym for companies in San Francisco, on Hong Kong, all over the world, financial companies that are engaging in all kinds of leveraged investments that can go terribly south. You had a few years back, you had a guy named Nick Leeson, who in one night took down a 400-year-old bank called Barings Bank with one trade, where he decided that he was going to make money trying to arbitrage the Singapore market and the Tokyo market. Now, Nick forgot the fact that they have earthquakes in Japan, and so 5:30 in the morning, they had an earthquake in Kobe, Japan, and Tokyo's market opened up a whole lot lower because of that.
Right.
And consequently, he lost billions, and the bank went down with all the employees. James, a guy named Jerome Cavell, almost took down the third largest bank in France, called the Société Générale. He lost $7 billion for that bank, and because they had lost that money when Lehman Brothers went under, the only thing that kept Societe Generale from going under was its insurance policies with AIG. And AIG didn't have the money to cover that insurance claim. So AIG was about to go under, and Uncle Sam had to pour $80 billion in. And the first check that was wired was an $11 billion check that went to Societe Generale. So our obligations are national. You know, our country's obligations are extending to not only propping up the banking and insurance industry in our country, but in other parts of the world. That's part of what the book's talking about. It's talking about the fact that we've run canals of gasoline from financial institutions, not just within the country, but across the oceans.
Yeah. Well, we should be concerned. Every morning when we turn on the morning news, we shouldn't be surprised if we hear something startling, because we don't know what's going on, and anything could happen, and whatever happens is something we're not going to expect and never anticipated. Am I that a good statement to make?
there's a lot of economic risk. What you don't want to do is set up a financial system where you add on top of underlying economic risk associated with, for example, terrorism or or an earthquake. You don't want to layer on top of that man-made risk, and that's what we've got set up in this financial system. We've developed a huge amount of man-made risk, and the situation is actually much riskier right now than it was back in 2007 because Uncle Sam has put out guarantees, not just to our checking accounts and savings accounts and CDs and money market accounts and cash surrender values of our life insurance policies and Citigroup bonds and et cetera, but you know, if you add up all these, you know, add up all these guarantees, they're in the above beyond $10 trillion.
Right.
And if they get called, if we actually did have a run on the banking system in the U.S. and these other accounts, we'd have to have the government print $10 or so trillion. That would lead to hyperinflation.
Right.
And the prospect of that would lead everybody to run on the banks because they would realize that if they didn't take their money out, when they finally did take their money out, it would be worthless in terms of what it could buy. So we have this perception that we have insured deposits. FDIC is insuring our deposits.
Right.
Well, they're insuring we're going to get our pieces of paper back.
Right.
They're not insuring that we're going to be able to buy anything
that's
real.
Correct. Right. It is surprising that we never learned, well, we haven't learned anything from the collapse of long-term capital management. And I thought that was the wake-up call. Obviously, it did very little after that, other than pump more money into the system and made us realize that we can prop the system up if we get enough people together to cough up enough money to support it. And I guess we didn't learn anything from that, did we?
We didn't, and the financial shocks and collapses are getting bigger.
Yeah.
So we've got this man-made risk is getting expanded, and Uncle Sam now has become AIG to the Power 10.
Right. You know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Against nuclear economic war. Mm. Yeah, I was just saying that AIG was pretending that it could insure against nuclear economic war, and that's what Uncle Sam is doing that many times over.
Right. You are probably, before we get on to Greece, which I'm dying to do because it's this fascinates me, but you may be the only person that I've met that may be able to answer this question. How is it, or how could it be? I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma. How is it that 1 mile down the road, there are at an intersection, which is not a commercial intersection, it's a residential intersection, there are four banks. I mean, actually, three banks and one credit union. Not exactly on the corner, but within a few feet of the corner. If you had four convenience stores, they'd all go, the three of the four would go bankrupt, if not all four. How does an intersection, which is a relatively light intersection, support three banks, especially if you go 1 mile down the road, you'll find another bank? They pop up all over the place. There are more banks in this town than there are convenience stores.
Well, here, basically, in a nutshell, what's going on is that these banks and other financial institutions are borrowing money. They're taking in money. When they take your deposits, that's really in effect borrowing. They're telling you, we're going to pay you back for sure X.
Right.
Or if they sell you bonds or if they give you a CD, they're really borrowing money. And then they invest it they take it to Las Vegas in effect and gamble it.
Right.
And they gamble it in a way that has a pretty high mean return. So it's not really going to Las Vegas. It's investing in the private sector.
Right.
And generally they're investing in things that are not snake oil.
Right.
But the risk of those investments not paying off is being left in effect to the taxpayers. So they're subsidized on the downside. So that what they've done is socialized the risk and privatized the profit. So it's a great scam on the general taxpayer. And it doesn't happen every day that the taxpayer sees the scam in black and white, but we are seeing it now.
Right.
And even though, you know, if you had the president on the other line here, he'd say, but the Treasury is going to make money out of this deal, and the Federal Reserve is making money. Well, he's not counting the insurance that the government has given away for free, and he's not focused on the enormous risk that the government is sitting with right now, and that the government has placed us all under and our kids under.
Right.
Which is that if there was a run today on the banks, Uncle Sam would owe $6 trillion just to cover the FDIC liabilities.
Right.
Then there'd be a run the same day on the money market accounts. That would be $3 trillion. Then there'd be a run the same day on the cash surrender values of the life insurance companies. That would be another $3 trillion bucks.
Right.
Suddenly we'd have, that's $12 trillion bucks right there, and I'm not even getting into the other obligations.
Right. You know,
everybody would see that that's hyperinflation, then they would all want to run.
Yeah.
And so that's what Obama doesn't quite get, because his economics team doesn't want to, isn't telling him, or maybe he does get it, but he thinks this is that he can just get through this, but you know, and not run into that problem, and that's possible. But he's made our lives a whole lot riskier, and he's not pricing that.
Well, you know, apologists for this entire system referenced the Depression and said 3,000 banks went under during the Depression. I think it was, the number was somewhere around there.
Right.
And they said, look, we only have, 57 banks gone under. And they say, so how can you compare it? Well, my response to that is that the 57 banks, and if you want to include AIG and those as banks, if you will, financial institutions, if you look at the amount of money, even inflation adjusted, dwarfs, you know, the rest of that, you know, the 3,000 banks that went under. I mean, that was picayune stuff, because those banks were really very, very small. Is that a logical response to that?
That's a very good response. It's a fair response. It's not really too big to fail. That's not really the problem. It's not, because in the 30s, as you just said, it was the small banks that, you know, a lot of the banks, most of the banks that failed were small.
Very small, yeah.
So it wasn't bad. It wasn't, in this recent crisis, it wasn't too big to fail. It wasn't the existence of credit default swaps or the existence of CDOs. It was much simpler than that. It was just the sale of snake oil.
Right.
It was the Tylenol scare in a nutshell. And when people get frightened in this country about how the economy is going to do, what they do is they just sit on their hands when it comes to employing people. They just lay people off from one minute to the next and say, it's too risky, we're going to fire people. And then nobody wants to buy anything because they're afraid their jobs aren't going to last. And then you have the economy flip to a very bad equilibrium, and it can sit there and stay there for years. And that's what happened in Japan when they had their financial collapse. They sat in pretty much a stagnation situation for 20 years. And we can stay in our situation for 20 years until we get to a healthy financial system where everybody
right.
can see, okay, this problem has actually been fixed.
Right.
It hasn't been band-aided over. We've actually had open heart surgery because this patient has cancer.
Right.
And when doctors in the ER room see somebody with cancer that can operate and save the patient, they don't put a band-aid on.
That's right.
And that's what this administration is doing. And by the way, I'm a big fan of the president. I actually went and campaigned for the president in New Hampshire. I thought he was going to put together an economics team that knew what it was doing. He's got an economics team that's basically, you know, a revolving door with Wall Street, or they're heading back to Wall Street. This is not arm's length advice.
I don't see much of a change, actually. I was relieved that George Bush finally went under the bus and we had Obama come in, and then all of a sudden I saw the same faces all over again in the background. I said, what happened here? I was incredibly disappointed, if anything. I mean, beyond disappointed. I couldn't.
Me too. And you know, the president is he's a lawyer. He's not an economist. There are very we need simple solutions. We don't really differ, Republicans and Democrats, about what fundamentally we believe in. I think that's and the book at the end and the afterward has solutions for how to fix the tax system, how to fix the retirement system, Social Security, how to fix the health care system that are very simple, that should appeal to Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
And you can write them down on a postcard. You don't need a 2,000-page
right.
health care reform that we can't afford.
Yeah, I believe you're a fair tax advocate, aren't you?
Well, I call it the purple tax because, as I describe it in the book at the end and the afterword, you can describe this consumption tax in ways that are very appealing to people that are are fair tax adherents, and you can describe it in ways that sound like it's the most far left for tax reform proposal you can think of.
Right.
You can describe it as a wealth tax plus a means of lowering taxes on workers plus a Democrat. So if people read this book, they'll see in a couple pages that we are talking past each other. We're arguing where we actually agree.
Right.
Our problem is not disagreeing disagreeably. The president wants us to disagree agreeably. I would like us to agree agreeably.
Yeah.
Because that's our real problem.
Right.
We actually have the same values, the same objectives, and what we've got is the bureaucrats who want to make things incredibly complicated for paying off whoever they're, getting paid off themselves to pay off. And you have people with no cojones here being able to say, look, we have to scrap what we've got because it's just not working and have a clean slate and do something that can be explained on a postcard to people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and to the average American, typical American, that they'll understand.
Right.
And that will restore trust and confidence in the economy, get us back to work.
Okay. Let me just interrupt for a second for station identification, folks. This is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano. We are pleased to have with us Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, professor of economics, Boston University, very knowledgeable about the economic situation. And please call. And we do have a caller, finally, who's been holding on for quite a while. Let's see if we can get them on the line. Caller, you're on the line. Your first name, please, and your question or comments, please.
Hello?
Hello. Caller, you're on the line. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Pat. I'm originally from Okmulgee, which is near Tulsa. My question is regarding the debacle that has been the result of the transgressions maybe of Wall Street, do you expect that if they were able to pass legislation that that would result in any change in the way the giant corporations deal with each other in the economy? It seems like their interest is still going to be primarily corporate profits, and that unless they restrict every single type of new creation that could be devised, that there still will be instances in which some of the big companies are going to overstep boundaries, which will lead to difficulty for the rest of the nation.
Right.
And I'll go ahead.
I get your point. It's a very good question. So you could, what are called, increase capital requirements so that companies can't borrow as much to invest in risky assets. But in this day and age, all it takes is one investment. It might be a relatively small investment in something that looks extremely safe, except that there's one circumstance in which this company called Citigroup owes $3 trillion. And they make that deal, and some regulator, we had 115 regulatory bodies, state and federal, who are asleep at the wheel. Let's suppose that they continue to sleep, and they miss this particular transaction. And suddenly, that extreme tail event occurs, and Citigroup owes $3 trillion, and it's too big to fail. Suddenly, the taxpayer is out $3 trillion, which is one quarter, roughly, of national income. That's, I think, the nightmare scenario you're talking about. And very astutely, and what I'm proposing with mutual funds, that would never happen because mutual funds never can have obligations that go beyond the assets of the mutual fund. They can never write contracts like that. That all they can do is buy securities that have been rated, verified, disclosed. And appraised by the Federal Financial Authority, and that would not have liabilities that go beyond the holdings of the mutual fund in any circumstance. So we have to put a stop to this gambling with other people's money. When you make a bet like that that leaves a company like Citigroup exposed to a huge sum, then that's a liability to the taxpayer, and we have to protect ourselves from those kinds of deals. Now, this is not fictitious. This is not an extreme, unbelievable story that I'm telling. We have a $600 trillion derivatives market. It's not hard to contemplate a trade that would involve a $3 trillion liabilities. AIG, March a year ago, released on its website a statement saying they had $1.6 trillion in CDS exposure, which are now the liabilities of us, because we're the owners of AIG. And we don't know whether these are gross or net liabilities. We don't know, because again, they don't disclose because they don't think they need to disclose. So this proprietary information, everybody in Wall Street is saying, we can't tell you what we're doing because, you know what, if we do, we're going to lose our ability to make you a mint. Well, not everybody can beat the market, and that's really just a way of them to keep us from seeing, it's allowing them to manufacture and sell snake oil without it being disclosed. So that would end under what I'm proposing.
Okay, Pat, does that
happen? I have one last little question. Okay. Could I ask one more question?
Yes, please. Yeah, make it. I hope it's a little one because we're running out of time.
We want to get on to Greece. Little. How do you avoid being depressed by all this information?
That was my question,
Pat.
This
is like the most exciting thing you could possibly expect to happen because we're like, you know, we read about the Great Depression and what happened and financial collapse, but we never experienced it. So for an academic economist, this is, unfortunately, it's nirvana for us.
Yeah.
So, but it's terrible. You know, I do fear for my kids and your kids and the future of the country, the way things are going. Yeah. So that keeps me up at night. And I spent the last year, I just stopped everything I was doing, and I said, we have to fix this problem.
Yeah.
So I am depressed, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm scared, I'm intellectually fascinated, but I'm also motivated to get this thing fixed. And Kotlikoff.net, if you can just send that URL to everybody you know and ask them to forward it, that's going to be the solution for our country, I think. And, you know, it sounds egocentric, but other people are coming up with a very similar set of ideas, so it's not just... Mm-hmm. Me, there's people in, lots of economists around the world are basically converging on the solution. Mm. I got there maybe 10 minutes early.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Pat, thank you so much for listening and being a listener of Liberty Talk Radio, and thank you for calling in. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye.
All right.
Did you want to talk about Greece?
Absolutely. We have 10 minutes. It's all yours on Greece.
Okay.
And then some.
Well, I think one thing we should say right off the bat is that the U.S., I believe, is in worse fiscal shape than Greece if you look at its long-term obligations.
Right.
Whether you look at the CBO data or the Medicare and Social Security data or the GAO's analysis or the IMF, which is going to come out with a study in a couple of weeks saying very much the same thing, this country is broke, more broke, I think, than Greece, which Greece has got lots of problems, but they have control of their healthcare spending. We have healthcare programs that are out of control, and this 2,000-page bill that was just passed has no, you know, surefire way to keep that spending from continuing to rise out of control. And we've now added a third entitlement program, which is the exchange system, the health exchanges. I'm all for universal health insurance. We absolutely need that. We've got 50 million Americans who are not insured. And I'm not a Democrat or Republican, just so everybody knows this. And if you look at the back of the book, I have a solution, very simple plan, which is called the healthcare fix, the medical security system, which shows how to fix this. But unless we do something that really gets control of this healthcare spending, we are bankrupt. And we'll have a run on the dollar, and people will stop buying our bonds, just like they're stopped buying the Greek bonds.
Right.
So we have to worry that our policies are turning us into a third world country. And if you look long term, not just at the short term, our deficit, by the way, as a share of GDP, is almost as large as Greece's. Our gross debt relative to GDP is almost as large as Greece's. And our future liabilities are much worse. Mm. So you tell me.
Right.
Why are they running on Greece? They should be running on the dollar. And you know what? It's a matter of minutes before all the traders decide that all the other traders are going to run on the dollar. Then they're going to run on the dollar.
Right. Aren't they all they're watching the front door, and they're waiting for the first person to run out. And that's going to be the problem. Everyone's sitting there, but no one's heading for the door. But the first person who runs for that door is going to start a stampede. And that's the way I look at it. And maybe it's a warp
mentality. It's the lemmings, or the penguins, when they all crowd together at the edge of the they were looking for those killer whales there who might eat them. And then the ones at the back of this big pile up right at the push the guys at the front over the cliff, and then they all jump in.
Right.
Because your chances of getting eaten up are smaller if there's more penguins in the water.
That's right, right.
So that's why they all jump in together.
Right.
And that can happen with us too.
The euro. Do you think the euro has a chance of surviving all of this?
Well, I wrote an article in Financial Affairs, in Foreign Affairs with Neil Ferguson back about 10 years ago when the euro was initiated. About a month after it was initiated, the title of our article was something like The Demise of the Euro. So here it is. It had just been initiated. We were predicting it was going to collapse, and we were predicting it was going to collapse basically on this basis of what we've seen with Greece, which is
right. The
countries don't have integrated fiscal policies, and the temptation to want to be able to print money in order to pay for your bills is so great that countries, if they can't get their fiscal act together, may decide this is just too, the easy way out is to stop the strikes by the workers and unionized workers and just to go off the euro, go back to the drachma, print the money, have hyperinflation, and that's not really a solution either. You have to act like an adult. We need adults we need adults in all these countries to take care of their economy so that their kids are actually going to be safe. Now, there are adults in places like Canada and Australia and New Zealand. Look at those countries. They've actually got sound fiscal policy.
Right.
It's not impossible. You can actually have mature policymakers. You don't have them in Washington right now, with very few exceptions. The president has an obligation to get our fiscal act in order, and he hasn't. So far, he doesn't want anybody. He doesn't like to say no to anybody, and he's put us in grave financial risk because he's put us in even greater fiscal risk. These things are interconnected. If suddenly the Chinese decide to stop buying our bonds, our U.S. Treasury bonds, right. Interest rates will shoot up. The government will try and print more money. They've already more than doubled the money supply in the course of the last 2 years, print over like $1.5 trillion in the course of this event. They're going to print more money to try and lower interest rates, and at some point, people are going to realize that this is going to lead to inflation, and then we can have the dollar becoming a hot potato, and whether there's an explicit run on the bank or just people just stop taking dollars, they want us to just start holding something real, gold coins, furniture, whatever it is, cars. Prices are going to start skyrocketing, and we're going to have the kind of financial collapse and depression that we're really worried about.
We need to get to
limited purpose banking. Yeah.
Well, if you look at the entire planet, isn't the problem that the greenback right now appears to be, well, at least perceptionally, the world's tallest dwarf in the currency market? In other words, none of them are worth much, or none of them are really that good or that solid. It's just a matter of how do you compare to the one next to you?
Well, there's other things you can hold that are physical goods. You can try and buy canned goods, you can buy furniture, you could buy cars. At some point, Americans might buy Canadian dollar, they might buy the Australian dollar, they might look for the yuan, the Chinese currency. The Chinese government, for all its warts, there's a lot of lack of transparency there, so let me not talk about the Chinese. But there are things you can hold. Yeah, you can try and buy barrels of oil or whatever, or or gold bars.
Yeah.
And that happens when you when people really get into concerned about the value of their money.
You know, I had a fellow. I was actually at the dog park, you know, with my dog, and I got to speaking with this one gentleman. And I don't know how we got on the subject of the economy. You know, one thing led to another. And I said, well, I try to have hold on to as little cash as possible. You know, he says, well, he says, maybe you can do that. You probably have a lot of money. He says, what does a guy like me buy, you know, if you don't have a lot of money? And I said, toilet paper. And he looked at me, you know, I said, I'm not being funny. I said, you know, you buy things that you need, basically, and if that's what you can afford, that's what you buy. And he said, it's very simple. I said, I can't afford everything. I afford what I can buy. I said, and this is what I've been doing. And it sort of appeased him in a way, but I meant that seriously, but it came out kind of funny because the guy was complaining he had no money. And basically, if you bought extra food
paper
or whatever.
Is a real store of value, and when the dollar bill becomes a store of nothing, then people will stockpile toilet paper, whatever it is, that they can then swap for something else. We can move to a barter economy. Now, this is obviously an extreme scenario, but
right.
we've seen the impossible to imagine happen. So we have to worry about the complete meltdown. When we see Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, literally on his hands and knees, terrified, begging Nancy Pelosi to give him $750 billion to save the economy, and Obama saying that Bernanke kept us from the Great Depression, number two, we have something to worry about. We need to get the system safe. Jimmy Stewart is dead, has the answer, and I hope everybody takes a look at the book and then sends it to their members of Congress.
Yeah. Professor, we have about 3 minutes total till our lines go down. So if you want to take the next couple of minutes to promote your book, which is reason why you're on this program. We'd like to see if this book can be promoted for you, which will in fact help the economy and help us individually. I want to give you the couple of minutes to do some self-promotion, if you will.
Well, okay, I'm not trying to sell books because I don't make my living selling books. I'm trying to help my kids and your kids and the country that I love. And we have a system where the hucksters are able to take over. And that doesn't mean that all Wall Street is crooked or that all bankers are crooked or there's some conspiracy of any group here or that Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs might actually have been the more ethical player in this entire action if you actually look at it carefully, despite their hubris. They mark things to market much better than other companies, in fact. So we just have to realize that we have set up a system that works for Wall Street but doesn't work for Main Street. It's not safe for Main Street. We need to have Wall Street operate effectively in a way that helps Main Street and doesn't put us out of work and destroy our retirements. So my book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead, talks about how to fix things, but it also explains in very simple terms that a 12-year-old, I think, really can understand, and in humorous terms, exactly what happened. And I think people will enjoy reading it. The last part of the book talks about how to fix things, but the first part of the book is a fun read.
Very
good.
And
the last part of the book I think is fun, too.
Yep. By the way, we did get a caller, but he just hung up, and we didn't have time to take the call, unfortunately. So we had another call online, and we just lost him. Professor, if you would ask Norma to send me an email with a mailing address and your T-shirt size, I would be pleased to send you a beautiful Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt.
Great.
Okay.
Happy to do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much. What was that about?
Go ahead.
Thank you so much for being. Boy, that one. Thank you so much for being our guest this afternoon. I don't know where that noise came from, but good thing it's happening now. I want to thank you very much for being our guest. We consider it an honor, and the information that you gave us was very valuable, and we do wish you luck, and we wish the whole country luck, and hopefully we'll adopt the program that you're recommending.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you, Professor. Bye-bye now.
My pleasure.
This is the end of today's broadcast. We'd like to thank Grant Shakers Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends, and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle. You feel free, liberated. Your life is in your own hands. But with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal. The government hates competition." With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.